Thank you for attending session 328, titled More Than a Name, How Genealogy Connects Us. Please silence your cell phones. As you listen today, we invite you to explore what it means to be Mormon, who gets to carry that label, what does the history say, what does the theology say. At this conference, we encourage you to explore what it means, at this conference, we encourage you to explore what it means to be Mormon. We don't like labels because the reality is there are many labels as there are people, which is why you'll see that in your name badge sleeve, we have allowed you to label yourself the kind of Mormon you are or want to be. If you haven't yet, you are welcome to grab a Sharpie at the front desk to help disrupt the narrative of the one true Mormon, and instead tell us who you are. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone. 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk. Consider also purchasing Skullcandy official headphones customized just for Sunstone. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. This presentation proposes that the true purpose of genealogy is to help us get to know our ancestors. So, and I'm the presenter, and Kathy is my multimedia partner artist, who her passion is storytelling, and her wife Berta couldn't be here today, I was hoping, but otherwise you'll see them around everywhere. And with that, I'll just go ahead and get started. Okay? My genealogy story is pretty much the traditional Utah Mormon story. That generations of devout, stoic pioneers and all the names that people took to the temple. And I always kept hearing the phrase, is there work done? Is there work done? And so this is some Spanish Fork people. It's a Cox. Their last name is Cox. These are also Spanish Fork people. Evans family, they're also very handcart, all those stories of trials. And this is a Springville family, and this home is still there. I actually lived in it when I was a little kid. So, so in my family, and like most pioneer people, you know, descendants that I've heard of, there were the carefully curated, you know, really polished stories of Mormon convert heroism and adventurous frontiersmen. But really, even as I grew through my youth, I didn't really know about the people. I knew certain stories in the pictures that got shared a lot, and the same stories. But then there were other pictures and stories that I was to find out were there, but had been told less and less often, and people just, they slip out of the narrative, and you don't see or hear those things. So I always heard, I'm like, yeah, I know, my great-great-grandfather's wooden leg is in the Pioneer Museum. I mean, is it yours? Doesn't everyone in Utah have something in the Pioneer Museum? Big deal. So my husband, he's not from a Utah born and bred family. So one day he said to me, he goes, I get it. A bunch of people came here on wagons. So that's kind of what an attitude that I run into when I start talking about family history in a Mormon circle, right? So, these are my parents. They got divorced pretty soon after, I was really little. And so then I was raised by my grandparents on my dad's side for 4 years. Being in their home, and my grandma's a very avid genealogist, and family history is just in their blood. I knew all about those same people on her side, but very little about my mother's side. The only image I really had of them was that they were a bunch of Jack Mormons from Spanish Fork. This is, on my maternal side, this is my grandmother right here. So, my father remarried shortly. My father remarried, and shortly after my baptism, or shortly before my baptism at 8 years old, and this introduced me to my stepmother, who became a big influence on me for family history. She's the one who took me to the Family History Center and showed me how to look at a census record. And I thought that was pretty cool, because then she would show me people that I knew, but in this paper, they were four. You know, like, what, Grandma was four? You know, and then who was this, and they did what? So that started to get a little interesting to me. And also, with my baptism, I was given a Book of Remembrance. Now, I don't know, is this anybody else's Mormon experience? If you... Yeah, so when I was eight, we get this. The first thing you put in it is the little thing you sign with your promises of baptism. And then it's all pages of family group sheets and pedigree charts. And the first thing I did when I got it alone in my room is I went through all the family group sheets, looked at the marriage date, and did the math between the marriage date and the firstborn child. Because I wanted to know, how far, how soon did you get married? But, you know, so that was an early sign of my nosiness, whether it was super effective or not, I don't know. But to me, genealogy still was in the framework of temple work. It's all, you know, that's what you do it for. You do it to take names to the temple. And that's the basis of it all. And so as I got older, now I mentioned my grandparents were big into genealogy. My stepmom, I was doing hers. I don't have a lot of influence from my mother's family. And so all I ever heard about was they got their work done. There's all the cards are all filled out. We're just waiting for the census to come out so that we can go get Uncle Robert's work, because he disappeared. We got to wait till he's technically 100 years old, and then we can do his work. And so it didn't seem like there was anything for me to do. Now, so I, you know, in my early adulthood, off doing not very Mormon things, hanging out, I was inactive. And so while I was living this way, I meet my first husband, and in that way that still, if you're a born and raised generational Mormon, you're going to have these impulses, or at least I did, where of course everyone in my family has to have their temple work done. So as soon as I was married and our behavior was no longer a sin, I could get ready and go to the temple and start Mormonizing his family. So, because they're going to be my family, we're going to have kids, my kids need everybody there in the temple. So this family, though, was interesting. This is my husband's first family. These are some ancestors in New Jersey. They're commonly known as the tribe. There's some Native American input, and so it's the Ramapo tribe. But there's also people of color from early on pre-Revolutionary War, people of color that were in the United States. So there was a lot of those stories. Besides being interesting, it was enlightening for me on a social justice level. Because of the people of color in their history and having been established over generations, that was in their history, they were stripped of a lot of rights. Whether you're looking at them as Native Americans or as people from early immigrants of color, before slavery even, they still were lesser than. So they were, as people of color, they weren't allowed to own property or weapons. Even though slavery ended, that was handed down. So that means that was just a way for them to take land, because they'd already had farms, and it was the prime land because they'd been there so long, and a pretty famous land speculator had decided he was going to sell people in England this land. So he sold people in England this land. They come over, and they've changed the laws now so that all of these people in this ethnic group are moved up into the rockier part of the mountains and, you know, clear out the farmland. That continued, and as I got through different parts of their lives, whether you're talking about their marriage or their schooling, you could see the discrimination. My going through a marriage record in the early 1800s, and again, this is post-slavery. Everyone, especially in the North, you hear a lot, oh, you know, we ended slavery early. They're like, they're better than the South. But you ended they ended slavery early 1800s, but that didn't affect anyone until they turned 28. And if a female enslaved person had a child before she was 28, that child then was enslaved until they were 28. So really, it didn't end. When I was looking up some marriage records, I knew these people got married, certain couples, and I couldn't find them. And so I was looking through the films, and the regular film of the county ledger, where the clerk enters the marriages, neat and tidy, I couldn't find them. Then I started looking around in other records of that county building on film, and one is a registration book, a clergy registration book. Because at this time, people didn't have the privilege of having a church right there. Everywhere you lived wasn't necessarily a church, and particularly since these people had been pushed up into the rockier parts of the mountains and into the woods, they didn't have a local church. And so itinerant preachers took care of them, and you've probably seen them in movies. There's one where Philip Seymour Hoffman. He's in a movie, and he plays an itinerant clergy person. But they would travel around, and they would stay in town and take care of the christenings and the marriages, and they kept a little notebook. And so then when they would go periodically to the courthouse, they would take out their notebook, and there's a log book for them, and it would say, I, Reverend Clarence Jones, entered into matrimony these people, and names and dates, and maybe christened these babies, names and dates. And what I caught on to looking at that book next to the ledger is that in that handwritten book next to every person of color, it's a little X. And when you went over to the ledger, the name before that person of color, and the name after that person of color, was listed in the ledger, but not the person of color. Because at that time, at least in New Jersey, if you were a person of color, you didn't count, your marriage didn't count, they didn't care if you were married, it's not valid. So that was one thing that showed up to me. Now the next, these people were pushed into three main communities, and one of the communities was Hilburn, New York. Now I don't know if you can tell from here, that's Thurgood Marshall. Thurgood Marshall, for Brown versus Education, his practice case was Hilburn, New York. They had two schools in Hilburn, one for these people that I'm talking about, my first husband's family, and then one for the white people. And the white school had heat, bathrooms. I mean, we're talking about 1930. And the people had tried to get them desegregated, and Hilburn wasn't having it. And so 1942, I believe, I could be wrong on that, but Thurgood Marshall was hired by the NAACP to come in and get it, desegregated. So doing his research was really educational and very addicting, right? It's like, you can't pass up these good stories, and it was like, this is all new stuff. There's no wagons, no hand carts, okay? This is all new. Eventually, though, that marriage ended, and we didn't have any kids, but I can't, so I still have friends and family, and we still go through this genealogy, which a lot of these people are very real to me now. So after a little while after I was divorced, and I'm still living in New Jersey, still not turned on by my own family, right? But right before I left, my stepmother had me look up something, and it kind of overlapped into something that was familiar of mine. And it dawned on me that here I've been living in New Jersey for 20 years, and there's a cemetery not 40 miles from me that the last person, one of the dead ends in my genealogy, he and his wife are buried there. And I've never been, and I've been there for 20 years. So last week I'm going to leave town. There's no backing out, and I go there to look, and it's like downpouring rain. I didn't find a thing. But I had determined by then that I was going to get back on track with my mother's side of the family. And this is my mother. Her name is Kathy. And so since I was going to get to this dead end, so the best way was to start with what I knew and go through. So my mother was alive, and so I talked to her and got all of everything she could verify for me. Birth dates we knew, and you're going through the LDS ordinances as you're marking them down. So you're looking for the birth date, the name and a blessing, maybe, if you're lucky, baptism date, if they're boys, you're looking for ordinations, marriage records, And you might find a temple record if they got their endowments and then their death record. So, you know, I didn't expect to find a ton because this was the Jack Mormon side of my family. But what I ended up running into that was super interesting on that side of the family was, of course, polygamy. Several or two of Joseph Smith's former bodyguards figured into marrying into this family, and pretty notorious people. And then there were a lot of scandals. There was divorce and gangster crime, and these kind of things started popping up, which wasn't exactly not talked about, but it's why they had that reputation with my father's side of the family and other people. But I was too young when my parents got divorced to remember any of the acrimony or anything. You know, I was little. But it was always pretty clear that that's where the fault was on my mother's side. No one, like, said bad things about her, but it was more of a, due to the actual horrific childhood that she had had, her mom and her stepdad treated her very poorly. It was kind of, well, this is why she makes those mistakes. She made poor choices, but it's not really her fault because of the way she was raised. So, at the Utah State Archives, so this is another place, it wasn't going to give me anything for my ordinances, but the Utah State Archives, in the criminal records, there was a report that backed up my mother's stepfather had abused them so badly that he was actually jailed, which in 1950-something, it took a lot for the police to actually take a husband to jail. So, and this is my grandmother, and this is my mother's stepfather. So they were a lot of fun at parties, but when they got home, it was more like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf or something. So this was the reason that they kind of would excuse my mother's, you know, inadequacies. So then, also at the State Archives, I was able to pull up their divorce records. A divorce record in Utah, if it's 50 years or more past, it's a public record. And particularly older divorces, you're going to get a lot of story in there, and you'll see you might have framed a marriage a certain way and personalities a certain way, but then when you get into the divorce record, you can see that, well, maybe there was some other sides to this. And so it does flesh out your perception of the people. And so this man was my mother's stepfather through her childhood. He and my grandmother stayed married until the day my parents got married. And they divorced right after. So this is myself and my mother. We did a lot of talking about what had gone on in her childhood, and it kind of, in discussing her childhood and then my feelings about my childhood, we were able to kind of work things out and create some understanding for me. So now I wasn't angry at her. Now I was angry at my grandmother. You know, how had she left my mother unprotected, participated in those things. And so then my anger focused a little bit on my grandmother. Now, I knew her too. But by this time, she had passed away. But I knew her when I was little, and she loved me. Like, I was born on her birthday. Mm-hmm. I think it was frustrating to her that I have a name that is kind of androgynous. Like, she could never spell Corey right, ever. My cards came, but I always got cards. But they came with my name spelled all different ways. And I think she's very, very femme fatale kind of woman. So I'm sure giving a girl an androgynous name wasn't her number one choice. But anyway, so I expected to get through these dates and everything, because again, my plan is to get to that guy whose stone is in that cemetery I couldn't find. So getting my mother's records taken care of, going to look for my grandma's records. And, you know, LDS church records are pretty, they're picky. They put a lot of stuff in there. and they're prolific. So this is my grandma Norma, and I was looking for her baptism record. So I'm looking in a Spanish Fork church record. There's a page that says Mose, that's her father, and Lily, and that's her mother, and there's kids, and she's the youngest, so I didn't see her on that page. I went to the next page, and it's a whole other family. And they put in there, whenever you come into a ward, they say where you were before and when you came into that ward. So then, theoretically, I could look at this and go to the ward previous to see where they had lived. But I'm still in this ward in Spanish Fork should be where Norma is found. Her birth certificate says she's born in Spanish Fork. She grew up, I know where, I've been to the house that she grew up in. It's in Spanish Fork. So this is the ward record, 3 pages later. This is my grandma. She's not in with her family. And this date right here, it says received from Spanish Fork 2nd on the 6th of January, 1935. Now the other half of her family had been received from Salt Lake, Palmyra, something, about 6 months before Norma shows up here. So this is the first sign I had that there was something going wrong here, that I wasn't getting the real deal. I went back to the first half of the family, and I looked at who was there, and the oldest daughter is gone. And that is Blanche. She also wasn't listed. So you've got a family unit minus the oldest daughter and the youngest daughter. So it's not uncommon in my family, like I told you with those marriage dates and birth dates, first thing I thought of, Norma is Blanche's baby, and they're somewhere else. And so that church record gave me that. And I started looking up Blanche's names in the back to the archives and divorce records under, and found her divorce record from two men. And she had divorced her first husband in April of 1931 and married her next husband in April of 1932. And Norma was born 6 months right in the middle between those two. And save you the suspense, DNA confirmed that the second man was her husband, right? But I didn't know that then, right? All I knew was that now I couldn't tell which man was her father. So I went to look for her, you know, birth certificate, and when you ask for Norma D. Shepherd's birth certificate, here it comes. It says Lily and Moses' parents, and I know this isn't true, or I think really strongly it's not true. So then I went back to the vital records, and this time I asked for a birth certificate where I don't know the name of the baby. I only know the mother's name and the birth date. And I said, the father could be one of these two guys, or it might be unknown. Really, all I know is that this woman had a baby on this date. And she said, okay, I'll go get that. And went, and she came outside, I'm sorry, I can't give you that. Sealed adoptions aren't available till they've been done 100 years. So now I knew I was right. I didn't have any paper, but I knew I was right. And I went out in the parking lot and flipped out. So, so there wasn't anything I'd do about it, but, you know, you start to think when you have ideas about your family, and you do have to be careful not to pin your own projections onto people, but you do start to wonder, maybe I'm just nuts. So this is Mose and Lily, and they did raise Norma. Now, the sisters, Blanche, this one right here, oh, no, that's Norma, sorry. So Blanche, I had heard of her. I hadn't heard very much about her. She died young, they said. And then the other sister that I heard a lot about is Faye. So here's Blanche, and this is Faye. And these two sisters, whenever, you know, you'd hardly hear Blanche, but whenever Faye's name came up, there was a lot of whispering and a lot of, you know, it was electric, but it wasn't, you know, openly talked about. So what had happened was these two sisters had gone away to Sacramento, and they got mixed up in things like highway robbery, safe cracking, other kinds of criminal activities. So they it was still pretty openly discussed, though, that they sent money back, and that's where, that's how their family got through the Depression, because these girls were sending money back to their parents. Whenever you'd hear about Faye, they would just say that she finally did come home to live, but she would chase the Relief Society ladies off the porch. So visiting teachers had to pick and choose when they came, because she would just start cursing at them and scare them right away. So everyone's like, Faye's crazy. So at the time of my parents' marriage, that her stepfather, again, that had been abusing her and her mother for a long time, was all kind of lit up and drunk, and puts his arm around my dad's shoulder, and he says, "Now, Lynn, you don't want to marry a shepherd girl." It's a day of. And, my dad hates this man. So, but he's tolerating him, and Bud says, "Yeah, they're whores, and they're crazy." And with that, my dad enters into marriage with my mother. Now, my mom and dad loved each other, but again, her family left little to be desired, and I think that's a lot of why my father's family looked so attractive to her. You saw the grandma and grandpa on that side with the perfect little outfits and 50s looks. So that was what she thought she was entering into, and him too. So right after they got married, the in-laws, her parents divorced. And then Norma, my grandmother, married a few more times, but she didn't ever legally marry after she sobered up. So now this is Faye. Faye had been the first to leave Utah. So when Blanche, my ancestor, was married to the first husband, Faye is off in Sacramento already, and she comes home like this by the time my grandmother's married to the second man. And this 31, and it's there in Spanish Fork, it's very poor, and by now I think Blanche is kind of bored. She, marriage is not all it's cracked up to be. And so Faye takes Blanche away with her, and this is when the last time that Norma sees her parents. And they go to Sacramento, and they seem to be doing very well, but the sister's sending that money back. And it was known that to the family that Faye and Blanche were prostitutes by this point. There was little to no understanding of human trafficking. I knew about this already. It wasn't a surprise. I just didn't know that it mattered to me. I didn't know that Blanche was my great-grandmother. I didn't know that she was my grandmother's mother. So I had never really dug into this. And so as soon as the connection was made, in my mind, and with some pretty, strong backup, I told a couple people. And all of a sudden the lights went on. Norma's brother, he was the only one, I think, that didn't realize that Norma wasn't his brother, wasn't his sister, she was really his niece. The older sisters knew. But he was also young, and he'd been away at school because he was deaf, and his parents had managed to put him in the school for the deaf up in northern Utah, so he was away all the time, and he didn't catch, like you eavesdrop, since he couldn't hear, he didn't catch any of that eavesdropping stuff that a lot of kids do. So he didn't know that Norma was Blanche's daughter, but as soon as I said it, he goes, "Oh, so that's why." This man Porterfield had come, and that's the second husband, had been coming to their house in the summers every so often, and one time he had talked to Lee and said, "Do you have any pictures of Blanche?" And Lee's like, "Well, sure, I have one in my wallet." And Porterfield asked if he could have it, and Lee gave it to him, and Lee never understood why. And so another reaction I got when I told people that Blanche was Norma's mother, and this was on, again, small towns, but it was still my father's side of the family. I told a woman, I said that Blanche was Norma's mother, and she goes, "Oh, so that's what they meant when they said Norma was just like her mother." So Norma had a reputation as being wild. And so as soon as I let someone know that her mother had been trafficked, their first reaction is, well, now it makes sense. So in Sacramento, I think Faye had more street smarts than Blanche. And she did better, or, you know, maybe she was just luckier. But Blanche ended up paying the price, and she was murdered in Sacramento. The stories of her death, this is her mugshot. If someone who's been arrested at that time is then proven to have died, they'll go back through the mug books, and they wrote dead. You can't tell from here. Now, when I ordered this, this came from the Center for Sacramento History. So you always want to, if you're trying to find out more, you want to look in the area you're at and see if there's a historical society. And these are people that, for nothing more than the love of genealogy and history and research, they spend their days transcribing and photographing and making these books accessible to someone like you or me that isn't living right there. So I sent them an email, and she went through the mug books and she found this picture. The higher resolution image, this picture, she wasn't ever charged. They held her for 4 days. But in this picture, in the high resolution image, you can see her crying. Now, I was excited when I sent for the image, right? I thought, they told me they have a picture of her. I'm going to get this picture. And I was excited, like genealogy excited, right? But when the picture got to me, it got to me, okay? I had not been giving her a full balanced look. What would her life have been like? She was only 25. And here she's in that world where she's being trafficked. Police aren't going to treat her well for 4 days. That whatever happened in the police station and then she's not charged, I'm sure, you know, it just fulfills every story you think. So it brought me back to earth a little bit. And considering that this is who Norma's mother was, right? When Norma died, she was 5.5 years old. And I'm sure they didn't tell her right away, but they all knew. And so there was this stigma over, not only, you know, was she basically illegitimate, but her mother had, like, died and had been a call girl. And so they took her pictures down. Her father couldn't bear to see her face in the house, so they took her pictures down. Norma looked just like her, so they really couldn't hang up Norma's pictures either. And that's what Lee told me, that Norma never got... And she didn't know why when she was young, but, you know... So the reasons, the stories about how she was killed vary. Faye said that she talked to someone she shouldn't have, and she had been shot coming down the stairs of their hotel. They lived in this hotel somewhere. The inquest is completely false. Just real quick, that's a whole other story, but the positioning and the way, if anybody's watched a half episode of CSI, you could tell this wasn't true. But the police gave their testimony. The whole inquest lasted 8 minutes, and they didn't even do it till after they had sent the body to Utah. So if anyone had any long-term questions, it wasn't going to be looked into. So, and this is, they amended her record, that other pic, her mugshot. It says, shot and killed by Benny Espenson, a Filipino, in room 11,016.5 Fifth Street. He then committed suicide. Neat and tidy. Two people that society doesn't care about. You've got a trafficked woman, and at that time there was probably nothing lower on the scale in California than being Filipino. Laws enacted against touching people if you're Filipino, different curfews. So the articles in the paper were really small, and, you know, nobody checked it out. And her family is too scandalized. They're not going to talk about it. So what really happened to her probably lands on... I've kind of figured out who the trafficker is, but that's another story. So, with Norma as a child, she's growing up, and she doesn't know that this woman is her mother. She doesn't know anything about it. And she gets to be about a teenager, and all those older sisters are married, and she's their go-to babysitter. And she has four older sisters. Two out of four of the husbands sexually assaulted Norma. They felt, you know what her mother was. One of those couples would eventually divorce over it, but the other one stayed married. And Norma continued to see him at family gatherings. I'm not going to say which one he is in the picture, but this is Norma, and this is my mother as a baby, and this is Jarvie. Now, when Norma was about 15, she was being brought up like a typical Mormon girl. Like her mother had, who she thought was her mother, sends her to church. And but about the time she's 15, this man starts paying attention to her. His name's George. He lives in town. He drives a truck. He's 6 years older than her. And so, he's 21, almost 22-ish. And then somehow she ends up on a truck job with him for several days. She's out of town with him. And I don't know, because none of the people that were there at that time are left alive to tell me. I don't know what the family reaction was. I don't know if George... I think George knew and didn't care, just from other things that I've heard. But while she was still early pregnant, this is Jarvie, the man in that other picture, and he fell in love with her, and he's actually the one who told me who George was. So he knew. But he fell in love with her, and they got married, and she's 15 in this picture. So all of that kind of happened really fast. But she had tried, to be part of the little Mormon community, but I kind of think I feel like she was robbed of a chance to even be the good girl. These are her MIA, her young women's certificates that were signed by her leaders and everything. So she participated. But I feel like she was robbed of even that chance because of the way that people talked about her. They were clearly talking about her as being just like her mother if someone on my dad's side two towns over knew that. Right? So that, in my mind, started to affect how I viewed her. So her own family looked at her as damaged, and in that time frame also, you don't have a lot of options as a woman. So she gets married and tries to start her life. And let's see. So when I found these papers when my own mother died they survived my grandmother passed. So my grandmother still cared about them. My grandmother, and I'm never going to church hardly ever again, but she kept them. And so even that, like, there's these intangible things that when you think about why a piece of paper survived, that tell you something about the person who kept it. And you can go too far with it, but families that keep little mementos for certain reasons, you start to find out there's a story or something that gives you a little insight. On my stepmother's side, they've saved a little tag from inside of a sweater. On my stepmother's side, her mom was one of eight daughters during the Depression, and their parents were gone looking for work, so these girls had to handle it themselves. And they had one sweater that somebody must have given them that was like name brand. So they all took turns wearing the sweater. And eventually the sweater wore out, but they saved the label. And they pinned it in other sweaters. So they would go, and if they had something that looked nice, it still, it still mattered. And when we were going through my grandmother's stuff, we found that little label. So now, just as interesting as things can be that they hold on to. Since Blanche was killed, and I wanted to find out more about what that was all about, I had started to look into Faye. Now, the reason I found anything about Blanche was because she was killed, that inquest record was a public record at Family History Center, and in the inquest they mentioned her alias. And so the alias is what I used when I wrote to the Center for Sacramento History, and that's how they found her mugshot. So these are places that you're not going to find your typical baptism, marriage records, whatever, but it found her for me. Faye, like I said, I think she was a little slicker. I've yet to find, she had to have been arrested, okay, but she didn't use the alias that she used in the inquest report. And I haven't found her picture digging through mugshots of towns that I think she lived in. I haven't found her yet. Maybe she just was really good at it. So by now, after Blanche was killed, a few years later, for Faye's line of work, wartime pre-statehood Hawaii is where she went. A lot of money there. If you've seen From Here to Eternity, that's a very romanticized idea of what a USO girl was. I'm sure not all USO girls ended up, see that says USO right there, but in Hawaii, it ended up, a lot of USO places were fronts for prostitution. And these men are lining up to go see the USO girl. And you would see 4 men in an hour. It was set up so it's a quadrant. The man would come in the first quadrant. I probably paid before he got there. Become the first quadrant. Do whatever he was going to do. Get ready. His clothes. Next quadrant, he's in there with the date. Then he goes here. Then he goes back and changes his clothes. But then she's over here being trafficked in the next two quadrants. So in that way, there was always someone getting dressed and someone being serviced. So this is where Faye was. They'd hear from her now and then, but then they got a letter from a friend, also on Hotel Street, saying that Faye had been hospitalized. She had gotten too mired into... They made it sound like she was drinking. I'm pretty sure by now she was addicted to morphine. And so she'd been hospitalized for that, and they thought someone should take her home. She's just come unhinged. So somehow they managed to get her home. To Utah. So when Lee, that same brother, ended up being the most stable member of his family, he drove to pick her up in Salt Lake, and when she came to his car, he pulled up and she stood on the sidewalk, took a bunch of official papers out, put them down on the ground, and set them on fire. And so he's always remembered that because that was so strange. And she was wearing a turban kind of thing on her head, and when she took it off, there were marks on her head like she was injured. And so when he asked her what it was about, she said that her husband, who owned a tailor shop, that the tailor shop had caught on fire and burned down, and he died in the fire. Now she's a widow and she's coming home. So I wrote to the Hilo Police Department, or Hilo maybe, I should say Hilo. Yes. And they searched for any record of such a fire and didn't find one. But they did find 4 police reports involving Faye, mostly drunk driving, and one incident with she and her husband getting into a fight with another man. So, but it was a shot in the dark to even send them the request. But I proved who I was, and they sent it to me. When she came back, she was sent to the state hospital here in Utah. She would go in and out of the state hospital. This isn't how it looks now, but this is how it looked when she was there. She was taken in 4 times, and so intake, there's a process, and in that process there's interviews with family members. If you have a family member in Utah, and it varies state to state, but if you have a family member who is now deceased and you can prove your relationship, you can get their records from the state hospital, and it will tell you how much medication they gave you or gave your ancestor or family member. Why? It depends on how good of a note taker the intern or the whoever was on duty that night was. One of the things that came up about Faye when she was in the hospital was the length she would go to get medicine. She would, if she had a sore, she would make it look worse. She would put iodine on it, so really inflamed, and go to the doctor and say, this really, really hurts. I need medicine. And back then, it was still pretty easy to get morphine, especially if you grease the doctor a little bit. And for a few years while she was in and out of here, checking out, there was a local doctor in Spanish Fork that did let her grease him. So she ran out of money. All of a sudden, he was concerned for her health and didn't want to give her any more drugs. So I'm not sure when Norma found out that Blanche was her mother. I'm certain she knew before, probably before she was married to the second husband, since he knew about Blanche, but I don't think Jarvie knew. So somewhere in there. One of the other things in reading Faye's record, now it might seem like a tangent because Faye isn't my ancestor, she's my grandmother's aunt, but it turns out in that record, Norma shows up. She's the one advocating for Faye. She's the one telling the doctors, you need to look into substance abuse. I think, you know, Norma's drinking heavily herself, so maybe that's why she recognized some things in Faye, because the doctors are saying, oh, well, she's just out of her mind. She's saying all these crazy things that can't be true. And knowing what I know now, they were true. And things that they didn't catch things because it, I think intravenous morphine addiction was a little new to a lot of people. Some of the medical details in that report made it pretty clear that you could walk in, like, I could walk in if I was being checked into the state hospital with this. This is my stuff. Okay. And go to my room. They didn't check. She had a Kleenex box that she would not part with. So it probably had her works and her drugs in it. And so, but Norma would be the one that would come to the hospital and drive her home for weekend visits with their mother. And Norma was the one talking to the doctors. Norma was the emergency contact. So this was another side of my grandmother that I didn't know, because I'd been told all this time that, you know, she's just a drunk. She was a drunk and couldn't get her life together. But turns out she was working for her as a single woman by herself. Yes, she was a drunk. She drank a lot, but she was doing these things, advocating for her aunt. And I imagine, I hope that they got to talk in those drives from Provo to Spanish Fork in the car about her mother. So, and this is about that time. So this is Norma, and this is Lily, who, for all intents and purposes, was both Faye and Norma's mother. So in these stories, and I've not told you a whole ton, it wasn't always pleasant. I heard things that maybe, you know, they break your heart, whether it's when I saw that picture the first time, and I felt like a rotten person, you know, because I was excited for this like it was, you know, it was prize. And I hadn't even considered what she would go through and what I was going to see. So in that way, and I still haven't gotten past, so now I have a whole new branch. Her husband and Norma's father is a whole new section of family that I don't know much about. Completely different angle. Not Mormon. Texas takes me down into the South and over into Tennessee. And so I'm going to have a whole different framework. But what it was to me is that there's so much more than those little slots on those cards that you get when you go to the temple. I mean, I have a stack of those cards. I know where they are. I couldn't tell you everybody that's on them. You know, I don't do temple work now. But in my mind, when the scripture says that we're bringing the hearts of the fathers to the children and the children to the fathers, this is what this is. I don't think that those little papers with the little lines filled in are what they were talking about. They were talking about the healing and the relationship you can develop with these people that you didn't really know. And so that's what I get out of genealogy. And it was really, most of this adventure, my mother was alive for me finding out most of this stuff. She wasn't alive to find out that her father wasn't the man she thought he was. That would have been helpful in some ways, but you know, she knows now. So, but anyway, so you know, that's me, this is my mother, and these are two of my brothers. And so that's basically where I come at from genealogy, why I try to advocate for it, because I want people to have that healing and that awareness and that relationship that I found. Whether you ever take it to a temple, you know, I don't think that's going to make a difference, to be blunt. I think the difference is going to be made that when you if there's the after, you know, whatever your afterlife belief is, if it involves your ancestors, you're going to know them, and you'll be able to start from a different place than just this piece of paper in your book of remembrance. And that's pretty much the bulk of what I wrote down to say. Did anyone have any questions or research things that... I don't want to be super dry because the story is pretty good, but there's a lot of things I did leave out, and if you know, but anyway, anybody go ahead.
So I resonate with a bunch of things you said because I have a bunch of Mormon pioneer stock that in my own genealogy, like my own efforts, I've mostly ignored, because I've had family members who did a lot of that to go back multiple generations, and so they've covered all of the names and dates and, you know, those kinds of things, and the temple work side of things has never interested me too much, but I'm a very, very math and science kind of person, and so the names, the dates, the, like, official records are the things I go for, the thrill of the hunt of that.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom has started to go back through, especially on her side, and go through more of the stories and the pictures and the more personal side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know how to kind of start on that, just given my kind of proclivity for, I want to get another generation back and another
right.
generation back.
Well, and it's and this is why family working on genealogy is important, because you've got your personality type that isn't going to let people slide.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there'll be some people, oh, I saw it on a record somewhere, you know, yeah, this is when they got married, it's fine. But you, what I found helpful, and it never hurts, if you've got an older person in your family that you think probably has pictures, or if you find a few pictures, take them over to an older person in your family and talk to them. Just like show them the picture. They'll start to tell you stories.
Right.
And like that story about the sweater. We wouldn't have known what that little tag was if we hadn't heard that story about the sweater. You know? And that's where I would start. There's usually one in a family that has most stuff, but you could ask your mom, I mean, if she's into it, or an aunt or someone, if they have boxes tucked away. If somebody, we've found some things recently in my family that when my great-grandmother, not in this line, died, they just got packed right away. She had them packed very carefully and safely, and when they were given to someone, they were packed very carefully and safely. And there's pictures that I had never seen at that point, and I was 45 years old in a family full of genealogy, and most of us hadn't seen these pictures because they were carefully, safely packed away. But if you start asking, like kind of like when I started throwing Porterfield's name around, when you start asking, memories start to click, you know. In that, where those certificates were found, I was going to show you this too, just to be geeky about it. This was with those certificates, just a little. And I wondered, you know, I'm like, oh. And then when I read the medical record about Faye, there's iodine in here. So this had to be Faye's first. Like, it didn't say anything, but it had to be Faye's first. And it was saved with her. So those kind of things, if you hang on to them, even though you don't know what they mean at first, and it's like a real circular. You're like, oh, I've got this stuff, and I talked to so-and-so, and they said this, and now I've got to go talk to so-and-so again, because now I know this. And it might tax your social tolerance, you know, but pretty much all the people in an older generation love to have someone listen. They will love to tell you about things that they remember, and a lot of times they're probably being told, oh, I heard that story 12 times already, you know, but if you're asking for new stuff and you can tolerate the stuff you have heard already, you'll get more. But anyway, anything else? I think you're free to go, too, if you want.
Thank you very much.
So, you're welcome. Thank you. And hope you have a rest of good sunstone. And for real, if you have any other stories, I mean, questions, we can talk about it. But we should probably...
Tell us about the chest.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
This. Oh, okay. So this is my mother's ashes. So I just was bringing my mother with me. And... If you know me, this is not my normal everyday attire.
Awesome.
But this is my grandmother, okay? So this is my grandmother, Norma and Blanche. And when I came to work, So it's kind of an epitome. This would be all of my ancestors on my mother's side. So, okay?
You have curly hair.
I do. I had curly hair, and I had chemo, and then when it came in, it was even curlier, just a little coarser. But yeah, it's good. So, yep.
Put the glasses back on. I'm trying to take them.
Oh, okay.
That's great.
So, anyway.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for sharing.
Oh, sure. And I appreciate Sunstone having a few genealogy. Brenda's presentation yesterday was really cool. I think it's one of the pockets of Mormonism that gets a little sidelined in Sunstone because of the perception that either it's a lot of work or it's all been done or a lot of Sunstone Mormons aren't going to the temple.
I almost feel embarrassed sometimes to mention that genealogy is a hobby of mine here.
Oh.
So it's such a stereotype.
Right, it's so Mormon.
Yeah. Because it's tied up in people's mind with the temple. But,
right, yeah.
But as a black person, yes, I've done temple work, but I was doing genealogy long before I converted to Mormonism.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't what my goal was.
Right. So to do my mother-in-law's line, I actually had to promise her that I would never take anybody to the temple. She
yep.
was very hesitant
wow.
that
right.
I was yeah. going to kind of
yeah.
take over her family.
Right, and it is good to honor those things.
Yeah.
I was very had to deal with that in my first husband's family. Did you have a question?
I was just going to say, I really appreciate, too, your willingness to, like, address very head-on, like, issues of family history that are messy and, and complicated, and I mean, I actually don't know if there have been any presentations. I just barely got to Utah yesterday, and my sister said, "Did I go to Sunstone meeting?" And so this was a spur of the moment thing. I don't know if there have been any presentations in this session dealing with divorce this year, but I feel like divorce is something that's like especially kind of maligned in Mormonism, and the way it affects genealogy and the way it affects how family history is treated is really messy. And like, I see my own father, who is sealed to his adoptive father, but his, you know, like, I feel really interested in like my Sicilian grandfather.
Right.
The fact that they came to Helper, Utah to mine coal, and they did run the house in prostitution.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever have you done your DNA? You want to try that. One thing I'd like to recommend is if you go to DNA Detectives, if you're a Facebook person, if you're thinking about DNA, they do have a link. You can get your DNA from Ancestry a little cheaper. But it's also a good place to read stories and see what people found out. And like most of my theories and hunches throughout this whole thing, because I have a lot of, that's not your father, this is your father,
right,
in my family tree. And DNA has borne out all the theories that we were close to but couldn't prove. And interest in, if you have, so this is a grandfather of yours that would have been Sicilian?
Yes.
So you would, and if he immigrated that recently, you're going to have some really interesting matches that you might find. Mm-hmm. And there's always going to be surprises.
Oh,
just
yeah.
be ready. But you'll also have, but you'll have a lot of interesting things that you can find out about that way too.
Yeah, I really appreciate your approach. And like,
oh, well,
these
well,
people
thank
are
you.
Still valuable.
Absolutely. And I think part of something that I already felt that about secrets. I don't like them. I think they're damaging, but I think my maternal line proves it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? All those secrets about Blanche, but people are still whispering and pointing at Norma. And Norma, between the social standards and her family, the way she was treated, you're treated, we don't want to look at you, you look like this beautiful, horrible woman. So your beauty reminds us of her, but yet if you're going to succeed as a woman in the 50s, you're going to market that beauty. And, you know, and then to get caught up in attraction and all that, that's, you know, a whole nother ball of wax. But yeah, and the secrets didn't help. And it makes them fester. So.
Well, because also, as you said, she was already deemed to be damaged.
Right.
So it was not considered by I guess what would those have been, her brother-in-laws?
Yeah.
It would not considered by them to be doing anything wrong.
Right.
Because
right.
she was already damaged.
She's that kind of woman.
It was not like we went out and got this pure virginal young woman.
Right.
I mean, we dealt with damaged goods.
Right. Yeah, and that's the way. So in all of this, even some of the people I didn't flesh out that I like, the stepfather. As much as I hate to say it, I get empathy for him. You know. But anyway, so yeah, and so I think that it ends up being really rewarding, and stories and the relationship that you have with these people. So they're like my favorite people now.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming in.